Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, a mother, licensed marriage family therapist, an educator, eavesdropper, emotion worker, and mental health consultant. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all struggle with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello, Brian.
How are you today?
I am feeling okay. Yeah.
Just okay. You usually sound like you're doing better.
Woo, let's go. I'm great. Yeah, I'm a little pensive today, contemplative. Thinking about our topic, you know, it's kind of a difficult and touchy subject. So I'm coming to it from a more thoughtful, sensitive place. I'm trying to, at least. Mm-hmm. How are you?
I'm doing well. Yeah, just had a fun weekend playing music with Emily. And yeah, we got to play together again, just the two of us, which we haven't done. I figured out that was our third time. And I played guitar and she played violin and we played for our friend's wedding.
That's so nice.
Yeah.
So do you have a name of your duo?
No, I was just thinking earlier today we should come up with one and actually try and do more weddings.
I know, that would be fun.
Yeah.
You'd be able to take the family band on the road.
Yeah.
And Karen will start playing the drums.
Everybody says that and it's going to happen. I know it is.
That's good. We're ready for another family band, the Cowsills. That's dating myself. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that band? You're way too young.
I am too young.
Well, I guess Partridge Family.
I know them, yeah.
It's more universal.
Right.
The Cowsills was an actual family, though. Now I'm going to feel like we have to find one of their songs so that I can prove it to you. But I'm glad to be here today. This is a conversation with the reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And we get together every Tuesday afternoon from 2 to 3 to kind of share our struggles and our stories and our challenges and our heartaches and our victories. Just what's going on in our lives every day, just the whole process of being a human being and being one of many roles in our lives that we play and how we process all of it, how we make it happen. The reason that we do this is because I think when we share our burdens and we share our stories and we share our victories, it makes things a lot easier to cope with. That's why talk therapy is such a powerful tool, because when you go in and you are able to unburden yourself in some way, even though it might not take the burden away because we can't change those things that have happened in our life, but it can lighten the burden so we don't feel so alone with our struggles. And to also know that other people struggle in same and different ways, similar ways. You know, we take on challenges of our lives in different ways, but we tend to have similar struggles. And so I thought, what a great forum to be able to share our experiences and know that we're not alone and know that other people are, you know, having similar experiences at the same time. And how do we deal with it? How do we process it? Because I hate the idea that you have to go into an office to tell one person your story when we could tell our story here and maybe help a whole bunch of people instead of one person at a time. And if you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can always check out our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or our website, thereluctanttherapist.com. You can email me to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. And you can call in and talk to us at 805-781-3875 if anything's on your mind, burning issue, or anything comes up today as you hear a little bit of our story unfold. So our story today unfolds because of conscious uncoupling. And Gwyneth Paltrow and her husband Chris Martin's announcement that they were consciously uncoupling, whatever that meant to them, splitting up their relationship. And so there's part of me that wants to be annoyed, and I think it's because I'm not a huge Gwyneth Paltrow fan, so I'll just own that right up front, that I find her annoying.
It's good to put that out there, so we know you're coming from a biased point of view.
I'm already biased a little bit, just because everything about her is just, you know, too much. It's just too much. And so there's that piece. But then there's the other part of me that, again, wants to be very sensitive about the subject, because we're talking about divorce. We're talking about the dismantling of a relationship and whether or not they end up getting divorced. Maybe they'll consciously uncouple for 6 months and find their way back. But ultimately, we're talking about the painful reality of the ending of a relationship, and that it's never easy. And even if it's something a long time coming, or even if it's something that is inevitable, you know, even if it's a relationship that is so broken or irreparable, it's still painful going through the process of dismantling relationships. And so I the part of me that wants to just bash at the celebrity idolizing that we do, you know, and thinking that somehow celebrities have any sort of supreme understanding or knowledge about life that we don't as regular people have, that annoys me. But at the same time, I want to talk about this idea of conscious uncoupling or divorce or dismantling relationships in a heartfelt way. So that's my goal, and we'll see how we can make it happen along the way. So this idea of conscious uncoupling, on three levels, it kind of gets to me. One is the idea of, why do we continue to give credibility to celebrity relationships, you know, as some sort of standard that we should hold ourselves to? And there always is this shock that, oh, they couldn't make it. If they break up, how could any relationship make it? You know, this surprise that a celebrity relationship would come to an end. But when you talk about marriage and relationships, there's something really sacred about those unions, you know, that I think it's very challenging to live your life in a fishbowl and be able to maintain any sort of privately connected, intimate relationships. I think it's really challenging, because even without being in the public's eye, I think it's challenging to keep our intimate relationships together. But if part of your entire being is driven by publicity, you know, writing blogs and being on television and being in movies and being a rock star, and, you know, once you've opened your life up to that kind of public scrutiny or that public attention, you have to continue driving the publicity machine in order to stay in the top of your field, the top of your craft. So right there, you know, the whole idea that we put any credence in a celebrity relationship, or that we look to anyone who's a celebrity for parenting advice or nutritional advice or, you know, marital advice, is just silly. It's just silly. And the thing that's disturbing about it is that, you know, it doesn't impact people of higher socioeconomic status or higher education levels than it does, unfortunately, people who have less access to greater amounts of information. And so for the majority of our population, and it is the majority of our population who, you know, aren't in a higher economic level or a higher educational level, this they take in a great deal of their information about life, what is to be true, from what they see in the media, because that's the access. And so that's a concern right there. Is that how are the majority of people in our culture learning about relationships, learning about parenting, learning about communication? Because if you're not learning these lessons from your family, or learning these lessons from your high school or college or postdoc experiences, or reading, you know, books about it, how do you learn how to be in a long-term relationship? Secondly, when we look at celebrity couples' divorces, and or anyone's divorce to begin with, but as soon as you start seeing celebrity divorces up in television or in the media, it just continues that story that half of all marriages end in divorce. And we have this like running thing in our culture that half of all marriages end in divorce, so why bother? And that's the problem, is a divorce is kind of like a dominoes, you know, game, where when one person gets divorced, a whole bunch of people follow afterwards. Because if you're kind of struggling and you see another couple go down, it's easy to throw your arms up and say, we were never meant to make it. And the fact is, half of all marriages today do not end in divorce. Statistically, if you have a college education and you wait till 25 to get married, your chance of divorce is 19%. So that bodes well for you, Brian, you and Emily planning this marriage upcoming.
Yeah, it makes me feel better about it. I mean, I've felt fine about it anyway. I feel excited, so I'm not worried.
If you're listening, Emily.
Yeah, exactly.
Brian has no doubts. And if you're listening, if you just joined us, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and I'm talking today about conscious uncoupling, or the idea of dismantling relationships, divorce in our culture, and how do we process that as individuals? How do these celebrity divorces impact our own choices and decisions? Because we'll say right off the bat, it has nothing to do with it. You know, I make my own decisions, or I'm independent, but we are affected by what we watch and what we see and what happens around us, especially if we hold someone to some sort of ideal. And the thing that's interesting about the divorce statistic is that marriages from 1985 on have a higher success rate than those marriages from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. The boomers generation has the highest divorce rate. They've had the highest divorce rate since the feminist movement in the 70s, and they continue to have the highest divorce rate now, which is interesting. They've been married and divorced more times than any other generation, and even long-term marriages of the baby boomers are ending in divorce in retirement at higher rates than younger people's marriages. So I think we should talk, you know, a little bit about what the expectations are that people have when they get married. And then finally, I find it really disturbing that there is a lot more information when you start to do research on divorce than there is on marriage maintenance. If you start Googling information about marriages and relationships, you're going to see a lot more about divorce and how to get divorced and the legal ramifications of divorce and how to split up property. And I mean, it just goes on and on. There are so many. And then if you type in marriage maintenance or saving a marriage, you know, there aren't as many resources for that. We don't spend the time and energy, or I don't know who is not spending the time and energy, but we don't have easy access to information about that. So what do you think of this idea of conscious uncoupling? Is there such a thing as a good divorce? That was a term that was created in the 70s in a response to the high spike in divorces that came along with the feminist movement. You know, we moved very quickly socially in that direction as soon as women kind of charged out the door to go back to work or go out to the workforce and be part of the professional world. We saw the spike to 50-51% of divorces happening rapidly. And it was interesting because it came on the heels of a really stable period of marriages in our culture, because divorce has been a part of culture since divorce started in the 1500s. There has been uncouplings, you know, and divorces and marriages ending. That wasn't new in the 70s at all. But it was interesting because after World War II, we had a long period of stability in the culture. People were tired. They'd been through the 20s and the Depression and World War II. And so it felt like there was this kind of cultural settling down that people did. And so there was a relatively long, it was 15 years of real stable marriages, 20 years. But that's why the change to the high divorce rate in the 70s was so shocking. People weren't ready for it. And we as social scientists weren't ready for it at all. Therapists didn't really know how to handle this whole wave of people that were coming in to the offices saying, I'm not happy. I want to get a divorce. This isn't working. You know, I don't want to be part of this relationship. And how do I get out of it? How do I get on and move on with my life? So a lot of the therapy post-divorce 70s was about, you know, how to recapture your independence and how to celebrate your identity separate from that of your spouse. But we didn't pay a lot of attention to what was happening to the children of divorce in these families. We didn't really have any statistics. We didn't have any research. We didn't have any real experience with the magnitude of children whose families were splitting up at that time. And so in hindsight, we did a really poor job of helping children adjust to their new family constellations. And shows like The Brady Bunch, you know, kind of painted this really happy picture of two families melding together seamlessly, but it wasn't really the experience that families were having. And so after, you know, 20 years of this fantasy idea that we would blend families and everything would be fine, we now are looking back and saying, you know, maybe what's healthier for children is to look at divorce from or divorce and remarriage, not of a blending of families, but really the idea of step families, that you stay connected to your original biological family, that if we are going to help children to feel more secure when their families come apart, we have to help parents figure out how to stay connected in a co-parenting way. And so that there's this feeling that that original biological family is still connected through kinship, even if they're not living in the same household. And so we've learned through trial and error some ways to help children and families to cope and move on. But I'm wondering how anyone else's experience has been with that. How has your experience with conscious uncoupling or divorce or the dismantling of relationships. Because it's interesting, the research is all over the place when it comes to children and the long-term effects of divorce. It's just as easy to find studies that say that kids, you know, have a difficult time with behavior and adjustment and school and motivation and depression and anxiety. There is also studies that say that kids come through it quite well, you know, that they adjust, that we are resilient, that we are created to thrive. So what's been your experience? 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of our conversation every week. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And Brian, you know, you've come from a different perspective than I did, because my parents have been married for 54 years,
mm-hmm.
and through good, bad, and ugly. What about you?
My parents divorced when I think I was 7 years old, mm-hmm. and then have both remarried since. And so my mom's side, we have a kind of a Brady Bunch group, like two groups of kids got together, and it was fun through high school, kind of. But it was troubling to get through it, the early stages for me and my brother, for sure. To get to where we've been now, which is, I mean, I feel blessed to have divorced parents that still get along, and we still have Thanksgiving. We just spent Easter together with both my biological parents and their new significant others. You know, we still get together, and everybody's still one family.
And I think that really is one of the keys to the conscious uncoupling, if we're going to use that term, or divorce and remarriage or moving on, is how the parents, you know, react and how the family adjusts to the new realities of, you know, separate households but still one family. I read an interesting study done by McAbee and Mnookin that was done quite a long time ago, and it was during this time when they first started researching or throwing out the idea of the good divorce. And if it was possible, you know, to have a divorce in which the children could still thrive and feel good about themselves, and that parents would not feel bitter and angry as a result, and there wouldn't just be all of the continued negative experiences. And they found that there were four different kinds of parenting post-divorce relationships that impacted children in different ways. And so ideally, they talked about cooperative colleagues, which were divorced parents who had moderate interactions with each other, not daily, but the quality of the communication was very high and very supportive and very respectful and being on the same page as far as parenting. The other type of divorced parent was perfect pals, and these parents had high scores in interaction. They still stayed very connected and talked regularly about their parenting and what was going on with their children, and they had high levels of communication that were really positive. And then couples that struggled tend to be the angry associates, which had very infrequent interactions with each other and moderate quality of communication, and they tended to struggle more with co-parenting. And then finally, the fiery foes were the divorced couples who had very few, if any, interactions and very low, if any, communication. And that divorced couple tended to have the biggest struggle with their children, which makes sense. The children of those couples tended to have the most problems adjusting in the long run. So what's been your experience? What do you think of this idea of the good divorce or conscious uncoupling? 805-781-3875. Hi, Harry, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to mention how I think that the problem with the idea of marriage, mm-hmm. is that in our society, it's kind of assumed that you've got to have some sort of a long-term relationship in order to believe that you've got a first-class life.
Okay.
Or that you're a first-class individual. If you can just get into a loving, committed relationship, even without and best is if you can have a marriage license, but it's not necessarily required to still feel so good about yourself. Right? And that's the thing that that people really want. Mm-hmm. There are certain legal benefits that come with being married, like being able to visit somebody in the hospital and and so on. And I suppose if that's all you wanted out of a marriage, right, was somebody to file your taxes with, you could just sign a contract with the lawyer. But, I mean, have a lawyer draw up a contract for you to sign with mm-hmm. somebody. But that doesn't really quite fulfill what people are really looking for, which is some affirmation that they're a first-class individual, and here is another individual who's here to swear by it and show you the ring that shows it. And when you get a divorce, all of a sudden your first-class status is drawn into question.
I really appreciate your take on that, Harry, because I do sense in your voice this like almost a social cast of, you know, if you're married, you're in a different level than someone who's been divorced, and that in itself could cause trouble, or maybe we're looking at the value of marriage in a way that we shouldn't.
Yeah, I think it's a mistake to look at it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a mistake. I think that the way that relationships are expected to be structured is a mistake in this country.
Okay, well, that's fair.
And so I could talk about that with my friends for hours. But
absolutely.
But anyway, I think. But that's the short way to give you my 2 cents.
I appreciate your 2 cents, Harry, and I hope you'll call in again, because I like your thoughtfulness in the idea of, is it more of a social identity that we have when we're married, or is it really serving some sort of cultural purpose? Because, you know, from a social scientist point of view, we talk about the stability of culture, and that for the last, you know, few hundred years, we've kind of looked towards marriage as being that way, being the way that we provide stability to children, and therefore provide stability to our culture, because we see that people seem to operate better or more productively when they come from a supportive, loving home or foundation. So I think that's kind of the mindset has been. And I know that there's, you know, a long history of marriage and different reasons, you know, for being married, joining families together or gaining greater land. For a long time, you know, we married for security and for a partnership. And it took two people to run a farm. It took two people to, you know, run a business. Men and women were connected in the partnership of marriage. And then come through the 50s and 60s, and this is more for, you know, the middle and upper middle class and wealthy part of our society, where women kind of lost their partnership aspect of marriage, and it was much more dependent. You got married so someone took care of you. And I think that's where marriage started to really get thrown off the tracks, because it was no longer as much about a partnership, but more about a dependency, you know, where you depended on someone to pay the bills or to provide a home for you. And I think that's been, you know, since the 70s, the biggest shift is what we expect from our marriages is much different than it was 40, 50, 60 years ago. And I think that's what's cause this great feeling of instability, because it's hard to expect one other person to provide all of your emotional support, your companionship needs, your personal sense of fulfillment. That's a lot to ask from one person, but we see that much more with the younger generation, that they're looking for that one soulmate person to take this journey with. And it's less about dependence on each other, looking for someone to pay our way, but actually someone to be, you know, there by our side. We see people matching up much more, equal education, equal financial ability than ever in the past. So I don't know, Harry. I think it's something we could talk about for hours and hours. And thank you for calling. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. The number to throw your 2 cents worth in is 805-781-3875. You can always find us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, on our website, thereluctanttherapist.com, or listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. So, Brian, you are planning to get married in a few months.
Mm-hmm.
What are your expectations?
I actually don't expect much to change. And everybody tells me everything changes.
It does.
But yeah, see, you just told me it too. But I don't know. I don't think that anything is going to change. I feel like we've been living together for several years. We've been together for almost 5 years, I think.
But what are your expectations for a marriage? What is it? What are you hoping it provides for you? Why are you there?
Why am I there?
Mm-hmm.
That's a good question. It's just because of the society thing. That's just what we're supposed to do. It's the next step in our relationship to secure it, to promise ourselves to each other for the rest of our lives.
Does it feel important to you in raising a child to be in this relationship? Does it feel important to you to have someone to crawl into bed with every night? Does it feel important to you to have someone witness your journey, which is, to me, why I'm there?
It feels important to me to have Emily in my life every day,
mm-hmm.
and not just anybody, but to have her. I don't know.
I know. I completely put you on the spot.
Yeah.
But I think it's something that we should be thinking about, because if you're talking about a long-term commitment, you know, if we live to be 90 years old, you're talking about being married for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, back in the day when you died at 39, that commitment isn't as long as it is now. So some people, you know, argue that it's not realistic to expect that marriages are going to last 60, 70, 80 years. But ironically, you talk to some couples who've been married 60, 70, 80 years, and they wouldn't change a thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what made the whole life worth it, was being with this one person and having the experience of raising children together and then grandchildren. And, you know, I always laugh that nobody's going to want to hear the stories about your kids as much as your spouse, mm-hmm. or the person you made the kids with. In the darkest of times at home, I look over at Chris and go, well, we better make it through this, because I like to talk about our kids and no one else is going to hear our stories. But at the same time, we were kind of talking about this idea of conscious uncoupling or divorce and dismantling of relationships. And, you know, can we provide a space where our children aren't wrecked by the experience, or that we're not wrecked by the experience? Is it just a social expectation that we get married, or is there, you know, really a longer purpose in that, some reason to stay in that family nest? I think one of the things that's difficult in our culture is that we tend to be very individualistic. We're not a collectivistic culture like many others, where it's more about the kinship, you know, the mm-hmm. extended family relationships, that the actual individual marriages and little tiny families, you know, aren't center stage, where you're just part of a grand group of people, cousins, aunts, uncles, right? But what's difficult for a lot of people in our society is that you get married and you have kids and you live in your house and you become very isolated, that we don't continue to keep those connections with parents or siblings or cousins. And so it can get very challenging to just have one person trying to meet all those daily needs, or to, if you run into trouble parenting, or if you run into financial difficulties, or if you run into communication issues, I mean, all those normal things of relationships, if you don't have a safety net of people in your lives that you can kind of turn to, it makes it much more challenging to go the long haul. And the other thing that's interesting is that marriages are very vulnerable and fragile. And as I mentioned earlier, you can have this kind of domino effect, that if you're in a group of friends, or, you know, you're with other people whose marriages are kind of struggling and they get divorced, it kind of sets off this pattern of other people getting divorced. And the other thing we found is that for children of divorce, they may adjust and thrive. And as I mentioned before, we all have this capacity to thrive. But it is traumatic for children to go through any sort of ending of relationships, or their parents' relationships. We always fantasize our parents will be together. But more than that, my concern is that children learn by example. They learn how to love and be in relationships by example. And so one of the downsides of our divorce culture is that children of divorce tend to have a much higher rate of divorce themselves in the next generation. We see that one of the patterns that families carry down from generation to generation is whether they're going to have many divorces or strong, long-lasting marriages. And if you look at family trees, and look at your own family tree, kind of do a scan of your grandparents and cousins generations and parents' generation, and see if you have a family system of divorces or a family systems of marriages, because they tend to pass along from generation to generation. It's very difficult to do something well that you haven't seen done well before you. And I think that's one of the greatest things that troubles me about divorce and dismantling of relationships and the speed at which we divorce and dismantle relationships. And I think Gwyneth Paltrow's blog said that they'd been working at it for a year, which I think if you've been married 5 years feels like a really, really long time. But if you talk about being married for 40, 50 years, I think a year is a very short amount of time to invest in trying to keep things together. And I think that's a mindset that's changed from one generation to the next, that the amount of time we're willing to put into a relationship is much shorter. Our attention span is much shorter. Mike, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi. I really like the idea of conscious uncoupling.
Okay.
I don't know that much about it. The term really appeals to me. Mostly because, well, I'm gay and I'm married. I've been with my husband for 20 years. And I got married intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
So there was, you know, this notion of conscious uncoupling, I think there's the other end of it. I think there's the notion of conscious coupling.
Yes.
And people who choose to get married, you know, and I got married totally for choice. You know, I didn't have a kid on the way, and I don't have any social pressure to get married. I got married because I wanted to hook my life with somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually like the idea of conscious uncoupling, especially as it seems to be an alternative to the way we uncouple now, which is adversarially.
Mm-hmm.
You buy a lawyer, and I buy a lawyer, and we fight. And I think it's a real opportunity to do it differently. I like the conversation that Gwyneth Paltrow has started.
Well, and I appreciate the idea behind it also. I like that it is out in the public because I like your take on it, Mike, that if we're going to get married, if we're going to build our life with another person, it should be with as much intention as the idea that we're going to dismantle that relationship. And I think if we do our work on the front side, if we have a really clear understanding of why we are partnering with someone, what are our expectations, if we have a plan and a goal and a kind of a vision of our life with someone else, the idea that we would ever have to consciously uncouple would be greatly reduced. And I think, unfortunately, we jump into marriages so quickly that we don't understand the long-term implication of really hooking your life to someone, as you said, you know, attaching your life to someone else is a really serious commitment.
I agree. And I really liked how you conceptualized it as, you know, over the years, the dependency, partnership, or getting farm work done. And I like my relationship now because we intentionally created a partnership.
Mm-hmm.
He's not dependent on me. I'm not dependent on him. We didn't get together out of sexual impulses. You know, and I think the point that's really important is as you get coupled in the first place, you got to think about all of the things that are likely to change as you get older,
mm-hmm.
and have a plan for that.
Absolutely.
And people just today, just or any time, I guess, don't seem to think beyond the sex.
Well,
beyond the fun, and what happens when what's novel and exciting is now routine? How do you live a full and fruitful life with another person?
And I love that you brought that up, Mike, because when we look at the statistics of long-term marriages that are struggling or end in divorce now, it's generally because of boredom. People think it's from infidelity or financial issues. I mean, child rearing really is taxing on married couples. It's very challenging to keep your marriage together because it's so much work. But it's the boredom piece where couples will say, well, we lost interest in doing things together. We have different attitudes about things in life. It's like you kind of lose that connection. And it takes a lot of work, just like friendships, just like anything else, that I think we don't understand that in a long-term relationship, it's a constant maintenance thing. It's a constant reinventing the relationship. It's a constant, you know, rededicating yourself to that relationship. And I think, unfortunately, we've just gotten lazy in our culture saying, well, it didn't work out. I moved on, because it happens all the time. You know, we have a much more throwaway feel about it. And I think also this idea that we're supposed to be happy all the time, and that it's actually about our own happiness, that our life is only about us, that gets us into trouble. That's that individualistic mentality, that I am the center of the universe, instead of I am part of a group of people that I'm responsible to, and not just myself.
I love those points, and I'd like to make one other comment, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
I think that people have forgotten the business end of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, marriage started out as a property thing. It was inheritance, and it was families blending their assets, and it was property law. And there's been a good, I think, shift from that into adding romance and love and companionship and all of the things that aren't covered by property law. But we've gone too far the other way, I think. And we've forgotten that when you get married, it's a serious business commitment as well as an emotional commitment.
Absolutely.
And I think that prenups are a great thing for people getting married. They got to think about, what's your income? What's my income? What are your assets? What are my assets? And how do we want those to be divided if the relationship does come to an end? So thanks for a very stimulating topic.
Thanks for calling in, Mike. Have a great day. This is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and we're talking about conscious uncoupling, dismantling of relationships, and marriage, I guess, has popped in there too. Is they, you know, what is our reason for coupling today? Are we able to make it for the long term? Is that something that should continue being important to us? 805-781-3875 is the number to join the conversation. We'll be back to speak with Gigi.
That number again to speak with Elizabeth Barrett, the Reluctant Therapist, is 781-3875. That's area code 805-781-3875. Coming up at 3 o'clock, it's Fresh Air. New York Times reporter Joe Becker talks about a legal battle in the fight for marriage equality. Becker is the author of the new book, Forcing the Spring. It focuses on the challenge to California's Proposition 8, which brought together former opponents Ted Olson and David Boies, who argued on behalf of gay marriage in state appeals and in the Supreme Court. That's Fresh Air at 3 o'clock in just about 20 minutes here on Public Radio KCBX. The number again to speak with Elizabeth Barrett is 781-3875.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about conscious uncoupling. And at the top of the show, I talked about Gwyneth Paltrow's announcement that she and her husband, Chris Martin, were choosing to end their relationship. And they wanted to make sure that they did it in a way that still maintained the connection of their family, that it still kept their children feeling like they had a family and that they were going to be cared for. And I really respect that idea that if we're going to dismantle a relationship, that we keep in mind that it's not just about us, that we are part of a group that depends on us, whether it's children or our parents or our siblings. When we get married, our entire family gets vested in that relationship. And so it's not just a matter of two people saying it didn't work out. It's a matter of an entire community having to adjust. And if we thought about it in those much, much more large terms, I wonder if we would be so quick to dissolve relationships. Gigi, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi. Your last caller raised a topic that prompted me to call in.
Okay.
Because when you asked your friend there what he expected out of his marriage, you know, that when he said they were going to get married, and you said, what do you expect the marriage to bring to your relationship? One of the things that your previous caller raised was the financial aspect of marriage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the comparison of the financial ramifications of being partners without marriage versus partners with marriage. And your previous caller mentioned that marriage, you know, arose, the formal contract of marriage, was a blending of assets. And of course, from my perspective as a female, the contract of marriage is a guarantee that if the partnership doesn't survive and there's children involved, that the children and the caregiver of the child will be maintained. I mean, when you're talking about sailors and their ship captains, there's a duty for the captain to maintain the sailor if the sailor, you know, is injured on the job. And in the marriage contract, at least there was that implied guarantee that if the man or the breadwinner, which is usually the man, especially when you're talking about a long time ago, before there were public benefits, you know, if he was out of the picture for whatever reason, either by choice or by injury or death, then the woman and the child were taken care of.
And I think that that was something that has been one of the big shifts. And I think it's one of the things we've seen in the instability in the long-term institution, because now we see many more relationships from a more homogenous economic level, that, you know, women have risen to such a point that 24% of the primary breadwinners are women now. And so I think that that we have to start reinventing or reimagining what that relationship looks like, because it won't always just be on care and protection of the women and children if something happens, but it's about the care and protection of, I think, the family and the relationship, that we have to be much more intentional about why we enter into this. Because for many highly educated or higher socioeconomic status couples, you're not there because you need someone to pay the bills. You're there because you want to build a life and a family together. But what you're saying, Gigi, is still true for a great majority of people, that those in a lower socioeconomic status or lower education level, we have lower incomes. And so divorce and families dissolving or not getting married and not having protection for women and children is actually a true and real problem for a lot of women and children in our country. And we don't talk about it enough, because we only really focus on research done with middle and upper income families. We kind of ignore the idea that for a lot of women and children, that lack of stability of marriage or care really impacts our quality of life. And I appreciate you calling in and sharing your perspective. This is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. We're talking about conscious uncoupling, divorce, marriage. What is your perspective on this? Are we doing things right? Are we doing things wrong? I'd like to know what you think. Stuart, what's on your mind?
Hi. I'm an attorney here in San Luis County.
Hi.
And my wife and I are partners. And one of the things that we come across in our practice in an increasing amount are couples who enter into property transactions, economic transactions, without any agreements.
Hmm.
When people are married, economic agreements, there's lots of laws about the relationship and the economic relationships and how to divide property and mechanism for doing it if people can't do it themselves. But for people who don't get married, and that's an increasing number of people, I think. People have never sat down and said, this is the relationship with regard to this asset.
So what happens if the relationship ends then? Are they back in your office?
Often. When the relationship ends, they say, how do we fix this? And you say, well, you know, what's been your practice? What have you done? You have joint bank accounts? Do you have real property in both names, or is the real property in a separate name? In community property situation, you know, the income of both people is considered to be the income of both people.
Mm-hmm.
If they're not married, each person's income is their own income. And that's so when you somebody's making payments on a house, for example, and there's lots of houses being bought by unmarried couples, what kind of assumptions are made about how those payments are allocated? What are the assumptions about who gets what when the relationship breaks down? Often what happens is the higher earner is the one who has the most ability to drive the solution.
Well, and it's interesting you brought that up, Stuart, because, you know, when we talk about living together, cohabitating, it's such a driving social norm that it's kind of like the divorce culture of the 70s. So many couples have jumped into living together that it's become so common. Everyone assumes that it's just a normal thing to do, but they don't talk about what you're talking about, which is the legal ramifications, that you have no protection if you just jump in and you get a dog together and a house
right.
together. And a lot of times these couples realize that they're trapped when they might have broken up and gone their separate ways. Once you've invested in a house and a car and a dog, it's much more difficult to break that relationship up. Where if you had dated...
Actually, the most difficult one is the dog.
Yeah, it is the most difficult. I have friends that have had custody battles over their pets.
Yes.
It's very emotional. And I think that's a whole other conversation we need to have, is just because something's a social norm doesn't mean it's in your best interest to partake.
Yeah. We've been thinking about this a lot because, you know, we do talk to a lot of people, and we've sort of taken the approach to people who come and talk to us actually before they start getting their assets together, and there's people that are starting to do that, is that we approach it in an estate planning kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are the assets? What happens if the relationship ends? What happens? Because prenups are designed for married people.
Mm-hmm.
Prenuptial, it just means the agreement is a before marriage agreement. But what about if there's no marriage? That's the really tough situation, I think.
Well,
because there's no structures in our law to deal with that.
And I guess, you know, it's going to be the cart's going to be pushing the horse on this one, because there's so many people are already in that situation. I guess we're going to have to backtrack with our laws.
Well, maybe backtrack with our laws, but I think another thing that we've noticed a lot is that problem solving,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, joint problem solving can be very difficult. And things like mediation is one way to approach it. But then again, if the relationship has gotten bitter, mediation is really tough.
Very tough. And there's nothing more contentious than a couple on the verge of divorce. I admire you for taking that. I admire you and your wife for taking that on. And I appreciate you calling in, Stuart. And please call in again, because there's always those legal pieces that I would love to have thrown in that people don't recognize as being important in all of our relationships. That, you know, if things are great when it's all wine and roses and we're all in love and isn't it beautiful and let's set up this life. But there is the reality of the day-to-day living with someone that is a commitment and it is a partnership that I think we tend to overlook. So thank you for calling in.
And that's the best time to work out the agreement.
Yes, during the wine and roses stage.
Exactly.
Thanks, Stuart. Have a great day.
You too. Thank you.
Leo, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Well, yes, and thank you for your wonderful words of wisdom over the weeks and years.
Thank you.
And my comments would start off with saying that I think that the institution of marriage is definitely an old-fashioned one, and very rigid and black and white. And I think I'm reminded of the television ad of IBM, where the suited men all walked in line with the same color suit. And it's kind of a one of those closets that restrict you. In other words, it's a rigid black and white sort of affair. And just as there needs to be conscious uncoupling, there really needs to be conscious coupling. And certainly there need to be more flavors of conscious coupling. The attorney, Stu, who was just talking with you, besides a prenup, if you devise some term for it, like pre-cohab agreement, it's just a creative attorney thing. It's not necessary to have laws. An agreement between people is an agreement between people and contractually enforceable. So you can have a lot of different kinds of flavors of relationships, and the society is evolving them. And I happen to think that it's a good thing that many, many more people are not locking themselves into a rigid structure. Although, of course, two things, at least, property ownership and children do, they don't really lock you in, but they mean you need a pre-cohab, a preceding arrangement of what to do. If pregnancy happens and if you have a child or children. And I think Gwyneth Paltrow is right on, although it needs to be expanded more. Creative coupling and different kinds of coupling and different degrees of coupling would be my suggestion for the future.
Well,
again, thank you for your comments.
Thanks, Leo, and thank you for taking the time to call in. And it is interesting because if we look at marriage from different angles, you know, we all come from a different perspective. Our worldview is different depending on our education, our socioeconomic status, our religious background, our family background. You know, if you come from a long line of people who've been married forever, you have a different view of marriage than people who come from families that have had a lot of divorces and split ups. I mean, all of those things shape our understanding or desires when it comes to relationships. So I think we have to keep that in mind. Also, like you said, there are different flavors of relationships. But I also think that it is our responsibility if you've had the privilege and the opportunity of a higher education or a higher socioeconomic status, to remember that not everyone has the same privilege of choice to get in and out of relationships. You know, it's nice for Gwyneth Paltrow to say, I'm going to consciously uncouple because she and Chris Martin can afford to make a life that's extremely comfortable for all of them for many, many generations. But if you come from a family that's strapped for cash or, you know, financially struggling or, you know, struggling for opportunities, don't have access to communication skills or problem-solving skills. I mean, Gwyneth Paltrow spends a lot of time with her holistic healer and all of her support team that have helped her to, you know, come to this place of conscious uncoupling. But from the perspective of a family therapist who spent a lot of time working for the county, it concerns me when we have someone like Gwyneth Paltrow making it sound like this beautiful, you know, we're just going to consciously uncouple and move on. If you're not in a financial position where you can just move on and still provide for your children, it's a big, scarier decision to make. And I think that's something we also have to keep in mind. But thank you for calling in, Leo. I appreciate your time. This is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Jeremy, you're on the air.
Hi. It sounds like you were starting to veer in the territory I called about, which is that the term conscious uncoupling, I think Gwyneth Paltrow spent more time with her publicist than with her holistic healer to come up with that term. Because to me, it means they broke up.
Yes.
I mean, what breakup is not a conscious uncoupling?
You think about it, right? Nobody just jumps in unwittingly.
Right. So I think it's more an inability to admit that she failed, or for any of us to admit we failed. Maybe that's why we stay in marriages we shouldn't, because we don't want to admit that we weren't strong enough or good enough to make it work.
And there is such a pressure in our culture, I think my first caller today talked about that, that we hold in such a high esteem the people that are married, that there is this fear of being, you know, cast out of that realm of the married world, that it puts a lot of pressure on people. But I appreciate you, Jeremy, for speaking to my cynical, reluctant side, that I do feel like when you have a celebrity who is really about maintaining and promoting their brand, it really is disingenuous to all of the people who are struggling day to day to to keep bread on, you know, food on the table and a house over their head and maintain their relationship with their wife and be a good parent. I mean, we are stretched. And so in order to continue to have healthy, strong marriages, I think we need to provide as a culture much more available resources for couples in communication skills, in problem solving skills, in legal help, you know, in financial help, because our culture was built around this idea that marriages and families are the foundation of our society, and stable marriages and families maintain a stable society. And yet we do virtually nothing to help families and marriages stay together. We do much more to help them break apart.
Well said.
Thank you for calling in, Jeremy.
Thank you.
And Bob, you're on the air. You get the last word today. What's on your mind?
I'm afraid my note is not going to be as cheerful as everything that some people have said.
That's okay.
But my experience has been that even very feminist women, in the context of a uncoupling, kind of revert to old stereotypes. And, you know, we want our men to be nurturing and involved with the kids and all that, and we want the women to be empowered and be able to, you know, live on their own terms. And yet, as soon as there's term, you know, talk of divorce, then, you know, men are sort of expected to go out and continue to be the breadwinners. And, you know, women will assume the role of the nurturer, and, you know, all bets are off. And I think the courts are getting better, but to a large extent still reflect the old stereotypes. And it's a struggle for some men to really, you know, have a say in how they want to raise their kids and not be looked at as just an ATM.
And Bob, and thank you so much for bringing that up, because I've wanted to go back and do a show about the changing world for men in our culture, because the feminist movement really has done a great job of, you know, helping women climb up ladders educationally, financially, opportunities. But for men, as you said, it's still very limited in the opportunities for men to choose different ways to be in relationships. Like you said, the courts still fall back on awards custody to women almost 70-80% of the time, even though we're seeing 24% of the stay-at-home parent as men. So I want to have that conversation very soon about the changing roles of men and women in raising children and in relationships, because I think it's a really important conversation to have.
Agree.
Thank you for calling in. This has been A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Thank you, Bob, for having the last word. And we have been talking about conscious uncoupling and marriages, and it's a bigger subject than an hour can hold. So I encourage you to continue this conversation on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. You can post messages to me or listen to old shows. You can find previous shows at kcbx.org. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. As always, we appreciate your participation in the conversations here. I appreciate our community in allowing us to kind of go down this road. And I want to encourage you to spend some time today being thankful for the earth that we live on and the opportunity to have these conversations. It is Earth Day. And if you get outside and lay under the stars or lay out in the sun and let yourself bake for a while, all those things that seem to be so overwhelming and so important and so I can't even think of the word I want to say. It's important to feel humbled, and we can feel humbled outside. So take time to honor the earth. Brian, as always, thank you for holding the room together. And I look forward to speaking to you next week right here on your public radio station, KCBX.